You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 14, 2024. I'm Becca from Drake University. Here is our first story. Our first story today is titled Illuminated Balloons Coming Friday Night to River's Edge Park by Scott Stewart. To start off, we have a picture of three large hot air balloons in what looks like another community event. So Friday night promises to be a magical evening at Tom Hanafan's River's Edge Park. The City of Council Bluffs is planning its first ever Glowing into Spring event, featuring a visual display of six illuminated hot air balloons. The free all-ages event runs 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. in the Riverside Park, along with seven food trucks, fire pits, acoustic music by Joe Reynolds, and balloon animals and glow sticks for children while supplies last. Glowing into Spring represents a celebration of community and the changing seasons, Council Bluffs Mayor Matt Walsh said in a news release. This event provides an opportunity for families and neighbors to come together and kick off the spring season in our beautiful Tom Hanafan River's Edge Park. While vehicular parking is available near River's Edge Pavilion, the city is encouraging local residents to use the trail system and will offer expanded on-site bicycle parking. Additionally, the first 100 people to ride their bike to the event will receive a commemorative Council Bluffs Trails t-shirt, the release stated. The food truck lineup features tacos, shaved ice, Bailey and Cooper's boba tea, Travel and Tom's coffee, Game Time Eats, Johnny Rico's Brooklyn Pizza, and Boxer Barbecue. Our next story is an update on the Carter Lake defamation lawsuit, and it's titled Carter Lake Defamation Suit Lingers, written by David Golbitz of the Nonpareil, and there are no visuals to this story. A defamation lawsuit centered on remarks made during a Carter Lake City Council meeting may linger unresolved for more than another year. The lawsuit was filed by former council member John Patterson, his wife Sharon, and city clerk Jackie Carl against council member Aaron Grell. The case is currently scheduled for a jury trial to begin March 11, 2025. During the public comments part of the October 16th City Council meeting, Grell, who was then a candidate for the council and was subsequently elected, engaged in a sometimes heated exchange with Patterson, who was not seeking re-election. They exchanged words over several topics, starting with an apparent rumor that the city was going to create a contract for one employee of the city, namely Carl. They moved on to talking about work Grell did for a client in his professional capacity as a plumber, and a disagreement over whether the city had accurately mapped the location of a water main. The exchange culminated with Grell accusing Patterson of lying about the plumbing situation before accusing Patterson and Carl of having an affair. "You're on your way out. I can understand that. You don't really care," Grell said. "You're trying to give severance packages to your lover or something. I don't know." The lawsuit accuses Grell of maliciously making that comment in public during the council meeting, despite knowing it is false. According to the lawsuit, plaintiffs requested a jury trial and are asking for an amount that will fairly and reasonably compensate them for their injuries, damages, and loss to the professional and personal reputation. The plaintiffs are also seeking punitive damages in an amount that would deter defendant and others from making similar statements in the future. The Pattersons and Carl are represented by Dvorak Law Group attorney Ryan Kufel. Grell is being represented by Joe Narmi of Narmi Law. Neither party's attorney responded to requests for comment from the Nonpareil. All right, the next story is titled Foundation Plans Annual Education Luncheon by Scott Stewart of the Nonpareil. Then we have a photo here of a woman up at a podium on a stage in front of, looks to be a couple hundred people, and it's captioned Ashley Cruz, former Council Bluffs Schools Foundation Board President, speaks at the Education is Everyone's Business Luncheon in 2023. The Council Bluffs Schools Foundation will welcome a national education leadership consultant for its annual Education is Everyone's Business Luncheon next week. The fundraiser, held in partnership with the Council Bluffs Community School District, will be held Wednesday, March 20th from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Mid-America Center in Council Bluffs. It supports the foundation, which provides financial support for the children, families, and staff of the Council Bluffs Schools. Steve Gehring with Four Point Education Partners will deliver a keynote address, according to a news release. Bridget Watson, the new executive director of the Council Bluffs Schools Foundation, and Council Bluffs Superintendent Vicki Murillo will also give remarks. The foundation will also recognize the recipient of its Community Impact Award. The luncheon is open to anyone in the community. Tickets are $50. For tickets or sponsorship opportunities, visit cbsf.org. All right, and we have another education-based story here titled Southwest Iowa High Schoolers Invited to Explore Ignite Pathways Career Programs. Ignite Pathways will hold a Southwest Iowa course fair in Woodbine on Monday, March 25th. The fair, which runs from 4 to 7 p.m., is open to all high school students, teachers, parents, and administrators to explore a wide range of educational opportunities tailored to ignite passions and shape futures, according to a news release. Ignite Pathways offers opportunities from career-focused programs to technical training. The fair offers an opportunity to enroll in courses for the 2024 to 2025 school year. The Southwest Iowa Course Fair promises to be an engaging and informative experience for attendees, the release states. With a diverse array of options available, students are encouraged to explore dual enrollment possibilities to find the perfect fit for their academic journey. The fair will be held at 6 West 7th Street in Woodbine. This story is accompanied by a digital poster for the event that says all of the information of what the event is about and when and where it is and their partners. All right, now we have a story titled, Three Graduates Will Be Inducted into Abraham Lincoln Hall of Fame on Monday. Three new members will be inducted into the Abraham Lincoln High School Hall of Fame during a public ceremony Monday. The ceremony, which begins at 6 p.m. in the school's auditorium, will be followed by a reception, according to a news release. It will be held in conjunction with the AL National Honor Society ceremony. Joining the Hall of Fame will be Aldine H. Kaufman, a 1940 graduate who had a career in the military and will be honored posthumously, Joanne Cooper Tews, a 1962 graduate who had a career in education, and Matt Johnson, a 1988 graduate who has a career in business and hospitality. Biographies of each inductee were prepared by AL students as introductory speeches were provided to the nonpareil. They have been edited for publication. Aldine H. Kaufman by Casey Woolers, accompanied by a military headshot of Kaufman. Colonel Aldine H. Kaufman served the United States Army for 30 years, upholding the four pillars of the National Honor Society, scholarship, leadership, service, and character throughout his life. From a young age, Kaufman always knew that he wanted to make a difference in the world and the Army. He knew the only way to truly make a difference and achieve his goals was to be not only a good leader, but a good person as well. Kaufman graduated from Abraham Lincoln in 1940 and attended Wentworth Military Academy, proceeding to graduate as a first lieutenant with an associate's degree in 1942. He chose to postpone his studies in order to take several military courses and serve in World War II and the Korean War. Kaufman was featured in the biography Follow Me and Die, in which he shared his experiences from World War II. Under heavy gunfire, shrapnel, and wounded men, Kaufman was forced to think and act quickly as a company commander. His quick thinking led him to radioing a nearby tank to fire on a house where a sniper was barricaded. Kaufman then entered the shattered building, locating two officers and seven enlisted men. Kaufman shot one of the officers, who raised his weapon, and the remaining men then surrendered. Over his career, Kaufman served in Korea, Vietnam, occupied Germany, and Japan. He lived in many places around the world. After serving in the Korean War, Kaufman returned to his studies and graduated from the University of Maryland in 1957. He then earned a master's degree in international affairs from George Washington University in 1962. Kaufman was promoted to a full colonel in 1965. His promotion recommendation letter cited his display of diplomacy and ability to work in harmony with other military services and other government agencies. Kaufman was awarded every dormant medal and decoration with the exception of the Medal of Honor, including a Purple Heart, Silver Star, and Distinguished Service Cross. He passed away in 2009 at the age of 87. He was beloved by his community, who described him as a perfect gentleman, a man of courage, and a great friend who touched many lives. Kaufman received many awards for his service and recognitions over his lifetime. He was not just decorated, but he was admired for scholarship, leadership, and character. Colonel Kaufman lived by his merit. He also served others before himself and accomplished his goal of changing the world. His son Michael said of his dad, "I have always been very much in awe of my father and still am. That is, I'm proud of him and how he has lived his life." Next we have Joanne Cooper Tews by Emily Billings, accompanied by a headshot of Tews. Joanne Cooper-Tews taught for 40 years and spent 7 years as a classroom aide, touching the lives of many other teachers and teacher mentors, as well as those in the community. Tews graduated from Abraham Lincoln in 1962. She was part of National Honor Society, Latin Club, German Club, and Pageant Club, as well as a member of the Future Teachers Club. She described her time at AL as quiet. After high school, Tews attended the University of Nebraska at Omaha and earned a Bachelor of Science in 1970. Tews later went back to UNO for her Master of Science in Special Education. She continued her education through Maycrest courses offered through Council Bluffs School District in 1992, 1986, and 1987. She also took 1987 Drake University summer courses, University of Iowa summer courses in 1987, 1988, 1990, 1992, and 1990 through 1992, University of Northern Iowa summer courses in 1990 and 1992, and state-sponsored math classes in Fort Dodge in 2005. Tews was able to lead in the classroom. She started as a teacher's aide at Rue Elementary while she was working on her degree. She taught for 40 years at Walnut Grove Elementary School from the 3rd through 6th grades. Her favorites were 4th and 6th graders because she felt they were always open to new ideas and eager to learn. Tews was able to reach and encourage struggling students and help many find the road to success. She also supported other teachers and those interested in entering the profession. She presented at several conferences and mentored numerous student teachers. Her nominator wrote, "It was magic to watch a group of teachers fall under her spell as she explained a new idea for a lesson or the organization for the upcoming softball season. Her compassion and knowledge immediately touched whichever audience she might be addressing." Tews also served as a leader outside of the classroom. She was one of the original 6 people who formed the Midlands of Iowa Reading Council and served as president, vice president, and membership chair and on the board of Southwest Iowa Education Association. Tews is a past president of the Council Bluffs Education Association. She was awarded the Nelson Family Foundation Excellence in Teaching Award as well as a UNO Distinguished Alumni Award. Tews volunteered for the Meals on Wheels and the Council Bluffs community where she felt was very impactful because people were appreciative and very kind. She was president of Council Bluffs Church Softball League and involved in the Fish and Game Club, organizing fish fries, among other events. Then we have Matt Johnson by Leah Johnson. Matt Johnson, accompanied by a headshot of Matt Johnson. Matt Johnson continues to live and own businesses in Council Bluffs because of his family and love of the community. He says his favorite part about Council Bluffs is the way the town embraces small businesses and makes it easy to have a business here. Johnson has returned the town's support by both starting and supporting several community events and organizations. During Johnson's time at AL, he was a member of the basketball team. One of his favorite memories is when they qualified for the state basketball tournament because of the way the school came together. After graduating, Johnson went on to earn his associate's degree from Iowa Western Community College and his bachelor's degree from the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Johnson worked in real estate for 3 years before he opened Repetition's Restaurant and Bar in the late 1990s. In 2001, Matt purchased Dirty Harry's on the historic 100 block and converted it to Barley's, a place to eat, drink, and gather. He expanded the property in 2006, and it has become a pillar of the 100 block. Recently, Johnson has started renovating another historic building on the 100 block to operate as a ghost kitchen. Johnson is also known for his support and involvement in the community. He is a current member of the Council Bluffs Convention and Visitors Bureau Board of Directors, Iowa Western Community College Board of Trustees, and Iowa Restaurant Association Board of Directors. He is also a board member on the National Restaurant Association Board of Directors. Johnson also serves on the Council Bluffs Community Schools Business Advisory Committee, the Kitchen Council Advisory Board, and co-chairs the Black Tie Scholarship Fundraiser at Iowa Western. He has previously served the 712 Initiative, Historic Preservation Commission, and Bluffs Downtown. Johnson has provided fundraiser opportunities for local schools, clubs, and activities at Barley's, and provides food for baseball and football events. He organizes and drives local events, including Bikes on Broadway and Classic Car Show on Broadway. He's also helped improve the 100 block by starting the 100 block street dance, Shamrock Shuffle, Blocktoberfest, and the 100 block group. He has advocated for the 100 block beautification and played a major role in bringing farmers market to the 100 block. Johnson has received many notable awards and honors, including the 2015 Iowa Western and Alumni of the Year, as well as the Iowa Restaurant Association's 2016 Iowa Restaurant Neighbor Philanthropy Award and 2020 Hospitality Owner of the Year. All right, up next we have a couple of local crime news stories. This first one is titled, Council Bluffs Man Pleads No Contest to Manslaughter After Fatal Gunfight in Omaha, written by Molly Ashford of the Omaha World-Herald. A Council Bluffs man pleaded no contest and was found guilty of manslaughter for his role in a fatal shooting at an Omaha car show last summer. Austin Peterson, 23, was found guilty Tuesday of fatally shooting 21-year-old Tristan Vincent after a fight broke out at a car show in northwest Omaha in June 2023. Three others, including Peterson, were also shot during the altercation. And then the story is accompanied by his mugshot. In exchange for Peterson's no contest plea to manslaughter, prosecutors dropped an additional charge of use of a firearm to commit a felony. According to an arrest affidavit for Peterson, police were dispatched to a parking lot near 90th Street and Military Avenue for reports of a shooting shortly after 8 p.m. on June 17, 2023. A large crowd of people were gathered in the lot for a car show. When first responders arrived, Vincent had been removed from the scene of the shooting by a security guard and placed in the back of the guard's vehicle. Vincent sustained multiple gunshot wounds and died at the hospital. Peterson had also been shot and was taken to the hospital. Two other people at the gathering sustained gunshot wounds and survived. Through surveillance video and witness statements, police came to believe that Peterson shot Vincent. Peterson agreed to be interviewed upon his release from the hospital and told officers he shot Vincent in self-defense after Vincent grabbed him by the neck. But according to the affidavit, surveillance video showed Peterson removed a gun from his pocket before any physical altercation occurred. Peterson shot at Vincent multiple times. A friend of Vincent shot back at Peterson. Peterson will be sentenced on May 6th. He faces a maximum of 20 years in prison with no mandatory minimum. And our next story here is titled, Two Omaha Men Arrested in Connection with Fatal Shooting During a Kickball Game at Fontenelle Park, written by Kevin Cole at the World Herald. A disturbance in a kickball game led to the fatal shooting of a man Sunday at a North Park, Omaha park, and the arrests of two other men. Tom Moo, 27, of Omaha, was shot in the stomach Sunday at Fontenelle Park near 48th and Pratt Streets about 6:20 p.m., Omaha police said. He was pronounced dead at the Nebraska Medical Center. Police arrested Chit Lay, 25, and Wake Say, 18, both of Omaha, on suspicion of first-degree murder, use of a weapon to commit a felony, and being felons in possession of a firearm. Say was also arrested on suspicion of flight to avoid arrest. Both men were booked into the Douglas County Jail late Tuesday. A witness told police that he was involved in a kickball game at the park when he noticed a disturbance in another kickball game being played nearby. The witness, according to an affidavit filed by an Omaha police officer, saw a man in his early 20s approach Moo with a handgun and shoot him in the stomach at a close range. The witness said the shooter and at least three other men ran to a white Dodge Challenger SRT with a black hood scoop that left the area westbound. Officers located a Dodge Challenger thought to have been involved in the shooting and attempted a traffic stop near 46th Street and Ames Avenue. Near 66th Street and Grand Avenue, a passenger in the Challenger got out and ran. The passenger, a 17-year-old male in possession of a rifle, was captured following a foot pursuit. The Challenger was being driven recklessly, a police spokesman said, as it eluded officers. The Challenger is alleged to have run several stop signs and red lights while being pursued by police cruisers and a police helicopter. The helicopter pilot reported the Challenger being driven at speeds exceeding 70 miles per hour in residential neighborhoods. At one point, the Challenger attempted to stop for fuel, but took off when officers arrived in the area. The Challenger eventually ran out of gas on Interstate 29. Say and Lay were taken into custody by a deputy from the Pottawatomie County Sheriff's Office. All right, and then our next story here is titled, No Injuries in Fight with Shenandoah Officer. An ordinary call to respond to a two-vehicle accident on March 2nd escalated into a distressing encounter for a Shenandoah police officer, Andrew Cameron. Dispatched to the 1200 block of West Nishna Road shortly before 8:45 a.m., Cameron found himself facing an unexpected assault allegedly perpetrated by a 41-year-old male involved in the accident, the Southwest Iowa Herald reported. The guy was kind of agitated, kind of provoking the other individual he rear-ended, Police Chief Josh Gray said. Gray said the situation took a violent turn when the person, seemingly without provocation, launched an attack on Cameron. In the heat of the struggle, the assailant managed to gain control of Cameron's service pistol from its holster, creating a potentially life-threatening situation. However, Cameron was able to maintain possession of the firearm throughout the ordeal. The altercation continued with both parties tumbling down a ditch into a nearby cornfield, where passersby intervened to aid Cameron until additional officers arrived. Formal charges were pending. Cameron did not receive serious injuries, nor did the occupants of the front vehicle, who did seek medical attention as a precaution. Next up, we have some news from the Iowa legislature. This article is titled Immigration Activists Protest Bill, written by Caleb McCullough of the Lee Gazette Des Moines Bureau. And then we have a picture here of what looks to be a, it's captioned, Iowa senators and immigration activists are seen at the Iowa State Capitol on Tuesday, March 12, 2024. Senate lawmakers advanced a bill to create a new crime of human smuggling that activists fear would punish people for aiding immigrants. When Manny Galvez arrived in Iowa after immigrating to the U.S., one of the first things he did, he said, was give aid to people in need because of his Christian faith. Now, Galvez and other activists fear a bill advancing through the Senate would make it harder for religious organizations and others to provide housing, food, and transportation to immigrants without legal status. The bill, which Republicans in a Senate subcommittee advanced with some hesitation on Tuesday, would create a new crime of human smuggling and penalize people who transport or harbor undocumented immigrants in certain cases. The bill would also make undocumented immigrants ineligible for public benefits, something that is already in federal law. Galvez, who has been working in the U.S. for 20 years and now lives in Iowa City, said while working with immigrant communities, he would never ask for a person's legal status before helping them. He worries if the bill were law, he could be prosecuted for those actions. When I was working in the streets of Des Moines, we never asked for a paper. We never asked if they were citizens or not, he told lawmakers on Tuesday. I think this bill is attacking one of the values of the state, because we have a Christian state, and this is against the values. Galvez was among the dozens that showed up at the state capitol to speak against the bill. The bill, House File 2608, has galvanized immigrant rights activists as it has made its way through the legislative process, along with a few other bills to restrict and penalize undocumented immigrants in Iowa. Opponents of the bill said, regardless of how it is enforced, it has instilled fear in immigrant communities across the state. Emily Sinwell, a member of the Iowa City Catholic Worker House, a group that works with asylum seekers in the U.S., providing the housing and transportation to appointments and court dates, said the bill was not a solution to the issues at the southern U.S. border. If we want solutions, this is not it, she said. This bill is only causing chaos, panic, fear among the state of Iowa and in our communities. Sinwell said she was worried the bill could make her and other migrant service providers guilty of a felony, and that it could shut down the operation of the Catholic Worker House. The bill stipulates that a person must obtain payment or some other benefit for the smuggling to be in violation of the law. Republican House supporters have said that provision would prevent prosecution of religious organizations and other nonprofits. It also carves out exceptions for people transporting or harboring relatives, creating an affirmative defense against prosecution for people who are closely related by blood or marriage. Transporting a spouse, child, sibling, parent, grandparent, or grandchild would be grounds for the affirmative defense. The standard punishment for violating the law would be a Class C felony, and the punishment would increase if the smuggled person is injured. A Class C felony is punishable by up to 10 years in prison. If the smuggled person becomes a victim of sexual abuse or suffers serious bodily injury or death, the violator could be convicted of a Class A felony, which carries a mandatory life sentence of life in prison. Opponents of the bill also argued the chilling effect it would have on immigrant communities in the state would hurt the economy by pushing immigrants out of the workforce. Ninoska Campos, a member of Eastern Iowa Immigrants' Rights Group, Escucha Mi Voz, and an asylum seeker from Honduras, said immigrants in Iowa do a range of essential work, from housekeeping and restaurant work to meatpacking and construction, and that passing legislation to hurt those communities would impact that workforce. These are all the jobs that we do to keep Iowa going, keep the economy going, Campos said through a translator. It would be hard to get up and go to work every day knowing that a police could stop our car and ask for our papers and arrest us because we're immigrants. Despite advancing the bill to the full committee, Republican senators on the subcommittee said they were uncomfortable with its vague language and would not support it in its current form. They recommended an amendment, though they did not say what changes they want to see. The Senate Judiciary Committee is set to discuss the bill on Wednesday. Senator Julian Garrett, Republican from Indianola, said the bill needs some work. I don't really like it very well the way it stands right now, and I agree with those of you that have made that point, Garrett said. I do think it needs to be changed. We'll have to work on that. Senator Jeff Taylor, a Republican from Sioux Center, said he thinks the language around requiring a payment or some other benefit to be in violation of the law was too vague. Senator Janice Wiener, a Democrat from Iowa City, said the bill could be subject to a constitutional challenge after lawmakers passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act this year, a bill to enhance religious freedom protections in the state. It's clearly against my religion. We're coming up on the holiday of Passover, which speaks specifically to the need to welcome the stranger, Wiener said. Heaven knows we need the workers in the state, and we don't want to be pushing anyone out. Our next article here is titled Nursing Home Cost Control Measure Advances, written by Aaron Murphy of the Lee Gazette Des Moines Bureau. A proposal to cap what staffing agencies can charge for the help of temporary healthcare workers, which Iowa's nursing homes turn to as a means of addressing employee shortages, is being considered by state lawmakers. The proposal supporters say staffing agencies charge so much for temporary nurses that it places a financial burden on nursing homes and other healthcare facilities. But the proposal has also been met with caution from staffing agencies, which insist that billing rates that spiked during the COVID-19 pandemic have been gradually returning to pre-pandemic levels, and warned that capping rates would only make the healthcare worker shortage even worse. Under the proposal, payment rates for nursing services provided by staffing agencies could be no more than 150% of the statewide average paid the previous year. The proposal was introduced by majority Republicans in the Iowa House and passed out of that chamber with strong bipartisan support. It is now being considered in the Iowa Senate, where the proposal went through its first legislative hearing in that chamber Monday at the Iowa Capitol. The stress in the long-term care industry is very real. I think everybody understands that, said Senator Jason Schultz, a Republican from Schleswig, who ran the subcommittee hearing. I do believe we are going to have a very robust exchange of ideas on this one, but that indicates just how much money is at stake on one hand and how difficult the long-term care industry is on the other. Iowa's nursing homes are losing money. Had it already been in place, the proposed legislation would save the industry $22 million a year, according to the testimony of Brent Willett, president and CEO of the Iowa Healthcare Association. Those dollars could be reinvested in increasing wages for permanent direct care staff, hiring more people, and not directed predominantly to out-of-state staffing agency profit margins, Willett said. But the proposal could have the opposite of its intended impact, argued Bob Livonius, chair of the American Staffing Association and board member of Grape Tree Medical Staffing based in Milford. Livonius said nearly two-thirds of nurses who work through the staffing agencies have other full-time jobs, and that those nurses could be driven out of staffing positions if the proposed legislation becomes law. He said that would create even more strain on nursing homes when they look to staffing agencies when in need of temporary workers. The organization that represents Iowa nurses shared that concern during the hearing. I will say nurses feel very targeted by this. There was a very negative reaction to this legislation, said Amy Campbell, a lobbyist for the Iowa Nurses Association. There are other traveling professions that have similar profit margins that are not included in this, so they felt very pulled out and targeted, and they have deep concerns that this is actually going to have the opposite effect. Senator Todd Taylor, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids, said his viewpoint on the proposed legislation has gone back and forth. I spoke with a lot of people last week. I was for the bill. I was against the bill, Taylor said. And this is not with any snark at all, but many of the bills that I've seen in this legislature, there is not really a problem that we're fixing. Here, I see there is a problem. I am concerned. Is this the right fix? The bill, House File 2391, previously passed in the Iowa House on an 80-17 vote. Schleswig and fellow Republican Senator Don Driscoll from Williamsburg advanced it out of subcommittee Monday, making it eligible for consideration by the full Senate Workforce Committee. Schultz said the goal is to at least pass the bill out of that committee in order for it to qualify for this week's legislative deadline and remain eligible for consideration. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 14, 2024 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Becca from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. Okay, now we are going to be moving on to the obituaries. Our first one is Rosemary E. Overholzer, and it's accompanied by a picture of Rosemary. February 5th, 1936 through March 10th, 2024. Rosemary E. Overholzer, age 88, of Council Bluffs, passed away on March 10, 2024, at the Country House in Council Bluffs. Rosemary was born February 5, 1936, in Clarinda, Iowa, to the late Wilbur and Helen McAllister Casey. She graduated from Clarinda High School in 1954, IWCC Clarinda Campus, and earned her degree in education from Dana College, Blair, Nebraska, in 1971. Rosemary married Dwayne Overholzer on November 25, 1955, in Clarinda. They were blessed with two sons, Breton and David. Rosemary taught kindergarten and third grade for 40-plus years for the Council Bluffs Schools, Madison Avenue, Dodge City, Kansas Schools, and C.B. Lewis Central Elementary from 1968 to 1996. She was an active member of Broadway Christian Church and PEO. She and her late husband enjoyed camping and were members of the Holiday Rambler Camping Club. In addition to her parents, Rosemary was preceded in death by her husband, Dwayne Overholzer, in 2002, and her brother, Robert Casey. Rosemary is survived by her sons, Brett Overholzer and Eileen Overholzer of Lenexa, Kansas, David and Suzanne Overholzer of Council Bluffs, seven grandchildren, Casey and Jared Parsons, Madeline and Austin Collins, Catherine Overholzer, Ellen and Connor Overholzer-Strait, Jacob Overholzer, Olivia and Joshua Smith, McAllister Overholzer, three great-grandchildren, Cole, Isabel, and Jace Parsons, nieces and nephews. Celebration of Life service Thursday, 6 p.m., followed by visitation with the family until 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Wu during Bayless Park Chapel. Private family interment on Friday in Memorial Park Cemetery. Memorial contributions are suggested to Special Olympics. We also have Beverly Joy Laver, May 24, 1932 to March 5, 2024. Beverly Joy Laver passed away peacefully on March 5, 2024. Services are pending. And we have an in memoriam here for Barbara J. Boer. It's been 16 years since you left us. You are always in our thoughts and forever in our prayers. I love and miss you, your loving grandson, Jeremy. All right, and our next article here is titled Bill Would Change How Schools React to Fire Alarms, written by Tom Barton of the Lee Gazette, Des Moines Bureau. A bill advancing in the Iowa legislature would require public and private schools to determine why a fire alarm went off before evacuating children from classrooms. Senate File 2191 was spurred by a policy developed by the North Scott School District in response to the 2018 school shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, where the shooter pulled a fire alarm. The bill unanimously passed the Senate last week and advanced out of a House subcommittee Monday. Introduced by Senator Chris Cornier, Republican from LeClaire, the bill requires all charter public and accredited non-public schools to include a policy in their emergency operations plan on how individuals in a school building should respond when a fire alarm is activated outside of a scheduled fire drill to protect the individuals in case the alarm was activated due to an active shooter on school grounds. This takes care of when you pull a fire alarm, you don't create a target-rich environment for a shooter, said Representative Stephen Bradley, a Republican from Cascade, who served on the House subcommittee. Margaret Buckton, representing the Urban Education Network of Iowa and the Rural School Advocates of Iowa, said school staff can very quickly check the alarm panel to see where the threat is, look at video feeds, check for smoke, and conduct firsthand inspections to confirm the threat before issuing a building-wide evacuation. All right, and then off of this one, we also have penalties for grooming by teachers advances. Lawmakers also passed a bill Monday that would require school districts to report to state officials if a licensed employee is disciplined for grooming or abusing a student. Current law requires that districts must report to the State Board of Educational Examiners, the state's education or licensing body, if a teacher or other license holder is disciplined for conduct that constitutes soliciting, encouraging, or consummating a romantic or inappropriate relationship with a student. House File 2487 would add grooming behavior and abusing a student to the list of actions that must be reported to the board if an employee is disciplined. Grooming behavior is defined in the bill as any attempt to seduce, solicit, lure, or entice a student or a person believed to be a student to participate in a sex act or engage in any unlawful sexual conduct. If the Board of Educational Examiners has evidence that a school staff member committed a crime, the board would need to report it to authorities under an amendment House lawmakers added on Monday. The amendment would also remove the 3-year limitation on investigation a complaint if it files under the grooming behavior definition. The bill passed the House unanimously. A Senate companion bill has not been passed out of a committee. All right, we also have here an article titled Senator Proposes Not Referencing Video, written by Robert Upsall of Iowa Capitol Dispatch. And then we have an image here of Senator Jeff Taylor, a Republican from Sioux Center, speaking to the Senate about a bill that would require Iowa schools to show fetal development videos and graphics in human growth and development in health classes. And this is from Tuesday, March 12th. Senate lawmakers moved forward Tuesday with a bill that would require fetal development videos and graphics to be shown in Iowa schools' human growth and development in health classes. Senator Jeff Taylor, Republican from Sioux Center, presented a planned amendment to House File 2617 that removes a specific reference to the Meet Baby Olivia video, produced by the anti-abortion group Live Action. His proposal instead outlines requirements on what schools must include in their curriculum for students in grades 7 through 12 related to stages of human development from fertilization to birth during a pregnancy. The requirements include showing ultrasound videos showing a development of brain and organs during pregnancy, as well as including computer-generated renderings or animations that depict the humanity of the unborn child. Many conservative and anti-abortion advocates spoke in support of the measure, advocating for more educational requirements on fetal development. As critics said the Baby Olivia video and the legislation was anti-abortion propaganda, Amber Williams, a member of the public supporting of the bill, asked why that's a bad thing. Because the reality is, abortion is painful and it's a barbaric procedure that ends a human life, Williams said. And it also destroys our lives, whether that be through shame or regret or depression or just broken relationships. So if this education can prevent that from happening to our young generation, and that's a good thing. Maisie Stilwell, a director of public affairs for Planned Parenthood Advocates of Iowa, said comments from the bill's supporters show that the measure is the propaganda that we have been saying it is from the beginning. Stilwell said that while she appreciated the amendments introduced by the Senate, the changes do not go far enough. We do believe that our young people deserve access to age-appropriate and medically accurate sex education, Stilwell said. And unfortunately, the prescriptive nature that remains within the bill leaves our students subject to the anti-abortion propaganda that we have heard by those in favor of the bill. So, students deserve better than what school districts would be allowed to put forth even after the amendment. Speakers with the school organizations took issue with the legislation requiring certain curriculum to be adopted by all Iowa schools instead of following the current procedure of having the State Board of Education adopt educational standards and allowing local school districts to choose their own curriculum to meet those standards. Melissa Peterson with the Iowa State Education Association encouraged lawmakers to follow the current process for setting educational standards, but also said that the ISEA was opposed to the politicization of any curriculum. It is really hard to believe this is not about politics, Peterson said. When you look at the registrations and the fact that from folks that we have heard who are already in support of this bill, some of them said that it's about abortion, some of them said it's not about abortion. I would encourage the legislative body to take the appropriate way out of this conversation and leave standards and adjustments to the experts, the education professionals. Senator Herman Quirnbach, a Democrat from Des Moines, warned lawmakers about passing measures mandating specific curriculum, pointing to existing Iowa code that states the Board of Education or Department of Education should not require schools to adopt specific textbooks or specific instructional methodology to meet core curriculum requirements, saying the bill violates this standard. Quirnbach also said that while he understands some people want particular types of content to be mandatory for schools, he said lawmakers should avoid curriculum mandates. Beware when you cross that line, Quirnbach said. Next group that comes along and wants to push a particular content may be pushing in a direction that you don't like. I think it's better that we withhold ourselves from that temptation and we allow local school districts to develop their own curriculum and make their own choices about their curriculum materials. Taylor said he believes there is flexibility built into legislation on allowing school districts to make their own decisions on what specific ultrasounds, videos, and other material they want to show in classes, and the requirements are not unduly burdensome or restrictive. He also said that while he understands concerns about the political nature of the legislation, he believes students learning about pregnancy and fetal development is important. We've seen advances in medical science in terms of ultrasound and even in utero topography, where we're able to see what's actually happening in terms of the miracle of life that is taking place within the woman. And I think that's not something that's propaganda, Taylor said. That's reality, and we need to educate our children in reality. The bill moves to the Senate Education Committee, with Taylor and Senator Sandy Salmon signing on in support with the recommendation for amendment. All right, now we have a story here about a local Catholic church. It's titled Celebrating 150 Years of Faith, Neola Parish Planning Weekend Events to Mark Major Milestone, written by Tim Rower of the Nonpareil. And then we have an image here of St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Neola. All right, St. Patrick's Catholic Church, St. Patrick's Parish in Neola, didn't celebrate its first Mass in a church. The Catholic parish gathered for the first time in 1874 in a private residence. It was in some home owned by a Mrs. Barry, but we don't know where the house was or who she was, Rochelle Jensen, the parish business manager, told the Nonpareil in a recent interview. Fellow parishioner Wendy Lawson said the church hasn't been successful with efforts to identify Mrs. Barry or the location of the home. Nevertheless, in celebration of the 150th anniversary of that first Mass, we'll go on at St. Patrick's Catholic Church, located at 308 4th Street in Neola. A weekend of special events, coinciding with St. Patrick's Day on Sunday, will fill the calendar in Pottawatomie County community. First up, the parish will host its last fish fry of the season Friday from 5 to 7 p.m., with a menu featuring fried Alaskan pollock, baked potato, Orsi's bread, coleslaw, relishes, and dessert. Grilled cheese can be substituted for fish. The anniversary events begin Saturday, when the Bishop of the Diocese of Des Moines will host an hour of prayer at 3 p.m., followed by Mass at 4 p.m. Mass will also be celebrated at 9:30 a.m. Sunday by the church's former pastor, Reverend Wayne Gubbles, and current pastor, Reverend Julius Itamid. The service will be followed by a parish group picture taken outdoors by a drone, said Lawson, who is one of the organizers of the anniversary celebrations. From 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Sunday, an anniversary dinner and other activities will be held in the social hall, she said. A slideshow, old parish photos, and artifacts will be displayed. I honestly got emotional doing family histories, Lawson said. The parish decided to celebrate this anniversary on St. Patrick's Day in honor of the church's patron saint, Lawson said. The first Mass was said by a Council Bluffs priest, identified in the church's records as Father McMenemy, who came out periodically to that community, Jensen said. As the town grew, including the number of Catholic families, so did the need for a church of their own. So, a small frame church was erected later that year under the supervision of McMenemy. Over time, as the population grew, this became too small, causing another priest, Father Schiffmacher, to acquire property for a new and larger church, the church which today is the pride of the parish. The brick church with a seating capacity for about 600 has a tall steeple that can be seen for miles. It is considered one of the largest country churches in the Diocese of Des Moines and a monument to Schiffmacher's history. His impact was also felt when he converted the old church into a parochial school, consisting of three classrooms, and engaged the Sisters of Humility of Ottumwa to direct it. School was in session until it closed in 1994, with the building being demolished about a decade later. During a recent Friday fish fry, numerous parishioners expressed pride in their church, not just its lengthy history, but also the many generations of families it has served. I'm a fifth generation, and my two kids are sixth generation, said John Fisher, adding that his grandchildren are seventh generation. Dean Schnichter's family goes back four generations. It all started with our ancestors, Schnichter said. They worked to make it, this what it is today. A lot of parishes have closed up, but this parish has stayed relatively stable. Fisher said the congregation has remained steady with about 400 families. At a nearby table sat Betty Masker, 94, a lifelong member of the parish. "My dad was a parishioner before that," Masker said. "This is a pretty strong church." The fish fry was held in the social hall, a structure built by volunteers during the Great Depression. Schnickner recalled that his wedding reception was held there 47 years ago. "It was also the site where dances brought out large crowds," he said. "With big name entertainment," Fisher added. One of the cooks at the fish fry was Roberta Morse. "I started here in 1975, Morse said. "I helped peeling the potatoes. It was such a welcoming parish," she said. In 1944, a farm owned by Thomas Monaghan was bequeathed to St. Patrick's. It was land that would be farmed by the parish, though it would have to wait until a renter's lease expired. "The parish broke ground on that land in 1953, Lawson said. "That first year, the farm brought in a $13,000 profit. "The land is still being farmed today," she said. Fisher recalled tough times during the farm crisis in the 1980s. "The church provided special Sunday services for struggling farmers," he said. "A church is a community," Fisher said. "It supports people in happy times and sad times. We've had a lot of generous donors, big donors, small donors, everybody contributing in their own way to keep this place going." The church underwent a major remodel in 1996 at a cost of $575,000. The church's pastor, Idamid, who came to the parish 1 year and 7 months ago, is looking forward to this weekend's celebration. "We are looking back to appreciate the seed that was sown over 150 years ago," he said. "That seed has grown into this parish. Our parishioners are amazing. They are faith-filled people who are always looking for God in their life." Lawson added, "It is a strong foundation built around family values. It's a foundation that has been here that long." Jensen said she hopes past parishioners and family members come back this weekend to enjoy the celebration with current parishioners. "This is a great time," she said. "Everybody is really excited about it." All right, up next, we have a story here about a proposal to expand Highway 30, written by Tom Barton of the Gazette. And then we have an image here of cars traveling on Highway 30 through Denison, and it was taken in May of 2017. Iowa State Transportation Commission would be required to prioritize making all of U.S. Highway 30 four lanes under a bill under consideration in the Iowa legislature. House lawmakers passed House File 2569 by a vote of 87-4 on February 29th, sending the bill over to the Iowa Senate for consideration. The bill would require the Iowa Transportation Commission to include in its long-range planning plans to make the entire length of Highway 30 four lanes, including a 40-mile stretch between DeWitt and Lisbon, just east of Cedar Rapids, and between Carroll and Ogden in western Iowa. Economic developers, business leaders, and government officials in Clinton County have advocated for the better part of two decades for the state to modify and expand Highway 30 between DeWitt and Lisbon to four lanes. Representatives with the U.S. Highway 30 Coalition have told lawmakers such a project would spur rural business development, foster population growth, improve roadway safety, lessen congestion on Interstate 80, and match the majority of Highway 30's cross-state footprint. Instead of a four-lane layout, the Iowa Department of Transportation's five-year highway plan calls for changing the current two-lane layout of Highway 30 from Lisbon to Stanwood to a Super 2 configuration that would enable the construction of wider lanes, a hard shoulder, and occasional turning and passing lanes. Work is scheduled to begin for the fiscal year that starts July 1st and ends June 30th, 2025, with pavement improvement from east of Lisbon to west of Mechanicsville. Property acquisition for the section of highway west of Mechanicsville to west of Stanwood is scheduled to begin in fiscal year 2025, with construction in the next year. Meanwhile, work is ongoing to finish four-lane construction in Benton County, which is slated to be completed this year, according to the DOT. Stuart Anderson, Director of Transportation Development for the Iowa DOT, said the department decided against a four-lane layout in favor of the Super 2 alternative due to cost savings. He said the DOT estimated it would cost 15% to 20% of the cost of upgrading to a four-lane highway and wouldn't require nearly as much property acquisition. The bill was amended to state the Iowa DOT would not use eminent domain to require land necessary to expand two-lane sections of Highway 30 to four lanes until it has expanded all reasonable alternatives, if the land is a part of Century Farm or residential real estate property. A study conducted by Iowa engineering firm Snyder and Associates and paid for by the Highway 30 Coalition estimated it would cost more than $636 million to expand a 45-mile stretch of the highway to four lanes between Carroll and Ogden and a 44-mile stretch from Lisbon to DeWitt over a 10-year period, and the estimated financial benefit to the state would be more than $770 million. Roughly 160 miles of the 331-mile-long highway in Iowa is four lanes. The study did not include the cost to expand the stretch of highway west of Carroll. U.S. Route 30, often called the Lincoln Highway, spans coast to coast from New York City to San Francisco. A fiscal analysis of the bill by the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency estimates the full expansion of Highway 30 would cost $1.5 billion throughout the course of construction. Federal funding could cover up to 80% of the total cost, but will depend on future state budgeting decisions. LSA estimates two lanes will need to be added to about 120 miles at an estimated cost of $6.7 million per mile. Four-lane bypasses would need to be constructed for about 39.5 miles, costing an estimated $10 million per mile, along with 16 interchanges costing about $16.1 million each. Annual maintenance cost for the full 120 miles is estimated to be approximately $1.7 million per year. There is over 500,000 people living along the highway corridor, and it's actually the only corridor outside I-80 that is growing, said Representative Tom Detterman, a Republican from Kaminosh, the bill's lead sponsor. Highway 30 has always been recommended as a four-lane corridor. 160 miles of it is four lanes, and so we need to finish it. Detterman said a four-lane divided highway is 60% safer than a two-lane highway. Communities in northern Iowa lobbied for years to make U.S. Highway 20 a four-lane expressway from Sioux City to Dubuque. The first four-lane stretch of Highway 20 was completed in 1958 and the last in 2018, 60 years later. Detterman said the state has seen economic growth along Highway 20 and is looking to see the same development along Highway 30. It's a win for rural Iowa, he told the Gazette, noting the highway spans 12 counties and 39 cities. Representative Adam Zabner, a Democrat from Iowa City, who voted against the measure, said while he would like to see the highway expanded, he's concerned about the potential politicization of what should be routine infrastructure spending. The bill now heads to the Iowa Senate, where Detterman said a subcommittee is scheduled to consider the bill next week. Senator Chris Corner, a Republican from LeClaire, introduced companion legislation in the Senate last year, but it failed to advance out of the chamber. Corner's district includes Clinton County. Detterman said he hopes to push the bill through the Senate before Friday's second final legislative deadline. All right, and then up last here we have some local sports. We have the 2024 All-City Boys Team for basketball, written by Austin Heinen of the Nonpareil. And then we have an image here of Lewis Central's Nash Paulson shooting against Omaha from Saturday, January 20th. The Nonpareil presents the 2024 All-City Boys Basketball Team. It was a historic year as three teams finished with winning records and appeared in one or multiple top 10 state rankings at one time or another. Therefore, it goes without saying that the city was loaded with talent this season. Per usual, this team was constructed based on the comments, insight, and suggestions of all five city school coaches and the opinions and observations of the Nonpareil staff. Without further delay, here is the 2024 All-City Boys Basketball Team. Jaden Calabro, senior, Thomas Jefferson. There wasn't a shot this guy couldn't sink. Near the half-court logos, in or around the paint, anywhere by the arc, defenses had to keep an eye on Calabro or they paid the price. Calabro led TJ with 21.1 points per game. He also led with 3.2 assists and 2.4 steals per game. Though Calabro may stand at just 5'8", he was also a key contributor at rebounding with 4.8 per game, which was third on the team. The stats sometimes speak for themselves. Calabro could do a bit of everything and was a team general. Calabro was also a first-team Missouri River Conference selection. When the Yellow Jackets needed a play or something to kickstart them, Calabro answered. Jaden led our team in scoring and was third in the conference, helped us secure a second-place finish in the conference, Yellow Jackets coach Donnie Johnson said. Nash Paulson, senior, Lewis Central. One of three returnees to the All-City team for the second straight year and for a good reason. LC made some noise this year, leaping from a 10-12 record to 14-7 this season, and Paulson was one of the keys to why that happened. LC had multiple contributors, but Nash led LC with 16.6 points per game. He also collected 4 rebounds, 2 steals, and an assist per game as well. He was also very efficient at the free throw line, shooting 88% on the season, which is the best on the All-City team. Was a first-team Hawkeye 10 honoree. He was our best player and our playmaker. When we needed a bucket, Nash was the guy who we went to. His development from his sophomore to senior year is something special from just improving year after year, Titans coach Ricky Torres said. Cole Arnold, senior Abraham Lincoln. The second of the 3 returners to the All-City team, Arnold could score the ball in various ways and was very efficient in doing so, averaging 21.2 points per game and shooting 53.8% this season, not to mention 43.1% behind the arc. This was the guy defenses had to plan for, and even so, still usually got his numbers. If you fouled him, he was an 85.3% free throw shooter, and thus would usually get the 2 points anyways. However, like the other players on this list, Arnold wasn't just a scorer. He collected 5.2 rebounds per game as well. A first-team Missouri River Conference player who will be missed next season in Lynx County. Cole was one of the most efficient scorers in the state at all levels. His percentages were through the roof in every category. He could score inside or outside and did a good job rebounding for us as well, Lynx coach Jason Isaacson said. Jordan DeWiley, senior Thomas Jefferson, the third of the returning trio to the All-City team. Jordan has been a key contributor for the Yellow Jackets over the past 3 seasons, but saved his best season for last as he averaged 16.9 points per game. He played with energy, thus leading the team in rebounding, with 7.9 per game, while also averaging about 2 assists and a steal per game. A second-team Missouri River Conference selection that will be missed in the Hive. A 3-year starter, second on the team in scoring, and first in rebounding. He contributed everywhere for us, Johnson said. Creighton Bracker, Jr. Abraham Lincoln. The only player in the city to average a double-double. If only an injury didn't cut his season short, it would have been interesting to see if the Lynx could have pushed further into the postseason. Bracker was second on the team with 14.7 points per game and led the team with 10.6 rebounds per game, including 3 offensive rebounds per game. The guy created second-chance opportunities and created multiple hustle plays that sadly there isn't a stat to show for it other than what's already said. Should be fun to see what he does in his senior season. Creighton averaged a double-double and generally guarded the other team's best forwards and centers. On top of the points and rebounds, he was an excellent defender. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 14th, 2024. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Becca from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.